Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about the rise of China as an economic power, what that means for the global economy, and perhaps also what it means for the United States. Certainly, the United States wants to have positive relations with China, but at the same time, we see China as a rival, and this suggests something of a dilemma for the United States in its foreign policy. Should we support China's development as a global power, or should we consider China to be a rival, go cautiously, maybe even take an adversarial approach in our dealings with China? That's the question we'll try to explore here this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Jeffrey Garrett. He's president of the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also professor of international relations, business administration, communication, and law at the University of Southern California. He's an expert on the causes and the consequences of globalization. He will be here on the U of I campus next week to give a talk. His visit is sponsored by the folks at the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance. He'll be talking on the topic Unpacking Globalization, What China Means for America. This will be on Monday evening at 7:30 at the auditorium of the Beckman Institute, and I think anyone who is interested in attending the talk should certainly feel welcome. If you'd like to find out more about the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance, they do have a website. You can go to www.csdg.uiuc.edu. You can go directly there. You can go through the U of I webpage, and that way you can find out more about the center. And if you're interested in this program that they're doing on globalization and the politics of economic adjustment, you can find out more about it right there. And of course, here on the program, as we discuss this subject, people who are listening are welcome to call. Just a bit more about our guest. Professor Garrett is the author of Partisan Politics in the Global Economy. He is co-editor of The Global Diffusion of Markets and Democracy and is currently working on two books. One, What China Means for America, explores the leading edge of globalization for America and the impact of China through the lens of four U.S. corporations, Boeing, Microsoft, Unocal, and Walmart. His other project, Globalization's Missing Middle, argues that middle-class people and middle-class countries have been the ones who have been the big losers as a result of globalization. Our guest has also had academic appointments at UCLA and Oxford, Pennsylvania, Stanford, and Yale, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, 333-9455, that's the local number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free at any point here. People are welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Professor Garrett, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I freely borrowed here in my opening from a piece that you wrote on this subject that was published in the LA Times. And one of the things that you write here, and maybe would be a place for us to start, is to talk in general terms about the significance of the rise of China, as I think that here in the piece that you write, the rise of China represents the most important shift in the global balance of power in at least 60 years.
Yes, I do believe that. I actually think two things are true about the rise of China. The first one is that the rise of China and the U.S.-China relationship will be probably, in retrospect, viewed as the most important development of the first decades of the 21st century. And the second thing is that I think, for obvious reasons, in the post 9/11 world, people in the United States probably aren't paying as much attention to Asia and to the rise of China as they might.
Hmm. I think that's interesting, considering how often in the past we have indeed paid attention to China, to Asia. And maybe I'm thinking particularly about the concern almost to the level of hysteria about Japan in the 1980s. Then when the Japanese economy crashed, it seemed that we forgot about that, and they, and our focus went elsewhere. Why do you think it is that, given that there's this great potential for the development of China, also India, other countries, Korea perhaps, why it is that that East Asia just doesn't get very much attention?
Well, I think I think you're exactly right to harken back to the U.S.-Japan relationship in the 1980s, something that I might return to in a second. But answering your primary question about why East Asia isn't getting the attention it deserves, I would have a very simple answer, which is the psychological and material shock of September 11 has had enormous consequences on not only elite attention, but also public opinion about the U.S. in the world. So questions about Islamic extremism, why do they hate us, things like that, war in Iraq, as we see with the upcoming congressional election, those really dominate, I think, both government attention and the public mind when it comes to international affairs. But obviously, if you dig a little below that, particularly you look at business and labor, one sees China as being an extraordinarily important and risingly important issue for the U.S. economy. And then sitting behind that, as you indicated in your introduction, there's the historical inevitability that rising economic powers tend to translate into political frictions between the rising power and in relative terms, declining power. So I think both in a geopolitical sense and in an economic sense, this China issue is just going to become increasingly important. There aren't headline events like headline grabbing events like lots of deaths in Iraq or something like that to get to the very top of the news cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're in this particular piece, and I'm sure elsewhere, you pointed out the fact also that there, for policymakers, for people in Washington, D.C., I think the word you use in this particular piece was ambivalence when you talk about what our strategy toward China should be. There seems to be a real mixed feelings about, well, are they our friends? Should we be cooperative? Should we consider them a rival? Should we not be cooperative? Should we even take a fairly aggressive posture? It seems that to this point, even in the circles where this kind of policy is made, people really haven't been able to make up their mind which way they think we should go.
I think that's correct, and I would just add one thing to it, which is that at the moment, at least, it's really a divide between the administration and the executive branch and Congress. So, one, there's a lot of evidence of congressional concern about China, both in geopolitical terms and in economic terms. Export controls, concerns about whether Chinese firms should be able to buy American firms in quote-unquote strategic sectors. Senators Graham and Schumer had a 27.5% across-the-board tariff bill sitting in the Senate for 18 months. So in Congress, there's China bashing is a pretty popular sport. The Bush administration, I think, both in on the economic side and on the geopolitical side, has been more supportive of China. Geopolitically, the Bush administration really needs China to help it deal with North Korea, and then economically, and particularly with the appointment of Hank Paulson as Secretary of Treasury, there's a view that economic engagement and managing the economic relationship is the way forward. But really the tension there is between this elite view that, let's call it an enlightened view, that having better relations with China really is in the U.S.'s long-run interest, and something that looks quite a bit like populism, populism come nationalism, which has both an economic and a security face, which has really been bubbling up quite strongly in Congress in the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned, and you touched on, too, the kind of concerns that we had back in the 1980s about Japan. And I think that people will very quickly remember, particularly in popular media, the kind of stories that were written. It was this consuming thing about what the Japanese are doing and how are they doing it and can we learn something from them and can we compete with them, and that it was in very real ways, I think people saw this, talked about it in terms of being warfare, as if we were doing the Second World War over again, but this time it was on economic terms, and this time there might be some question as about who it was going to win. I mean, that was really the tone of a lot of
that was the tone, but I think that the U.S.-China relationship going forward is going to be even more difficult than U.S.-Japan in the 1980s. Let me just make a couple of observations about that. It's true that the headline event in both cases was large, unprecedented bilateral trade deficits, and the notion that Japan then and China now have unfair trading practices with the United States, and that's translating directly into lost jobs, lower wages, and declining standard of living for Americans. So the underlying condition is the same. However, if you just look at the numbers, the U.S.-China trade deficit today is over $200 billion. That's more than four times as large as the largest U.S.-Japan deficit in the 1980s. So that would be my first point. Second point is that the U.S. was remarkably successful in reversing that trend and increasing U.S. exports to Japan, doubling them in the second half of the 1980s. And the way they did that was by getting a consensus, including from Japan, that the value of the yen, the Japanese currency, should appreciate radically against the dollar. And the yen more than doubled against the dollar between 1985 and 1989. I do not see a scenario in which the value of the Chinese currency, the RMB, an enormously important political issue at the moment, will double against the dollar anytime soon. And then last but not least, you mentioned the warfare metaphor for Japan, but it was true that in the 1980s, as continues to today, the security relationship between the U.S. and Japan was absolutely rock solid. Compare that with China, where there is real questioning about what China's security intentions are going forward. And the view there, which is whispering, but sometimes is expressed more strongly than that, including by the Defense Department, is that, yes, today China is all about make money, not make war, but that at the same time they're expanding their military capabilities more quickly than the economy is growing, and that therefore the United States must take the security challenge from China very seriously. So if you look at all, if you compare the U.S.-Japan in the 80s with U.S.-China today, I think there's every reason to expect that it will be much harder to resolve to manage the relationship as effectively as was the case in the 1980s. And of course, last point, the Chinese, it's not lost on the Chinese that Japan went into a 15-year economic slump after this policy to reduce the trade imbalance with the U.S. by doubling the yen went into effect.
Well, just to a couple of things here to pick up on. Before that, I want to ask a follow-up question on that last point. But I think that you're pointing to something that is important, that even during the time when the United States was really concerned about Japanese economic development and the fact that it was becoming an economic superpower, I don't really think that we were worried about Japan again becoming a military power like it was. So there's the significant difference between our concerns about Japan at that time and China now. Not only are we concerned about China and its economic growth, but we're also concerned about China as a military superpower. At the same time, I think you would suggest to people that if you're trying to draw some sort of parallel between China and the Soviet Union, as if we're going to have a new kind of it's more of the same. We're going to have a new kind of Cold War at some point, and that now the big rival is going to be China, where before it was Russia. I think you would say, well, you'd be a little careful about drawing that line.
I would say that, but there are people, including people in Washington, who are very concerned about, as I said, about China's rising military power. I have in front of me, in fact, a Defense Intelligence Agency estimate and prediction about Chinese defense spending. And let me just describe the graph to you. The first thing is that they estimate today that Chinese defense spending is about $75 billion a year. The U.S. is currently spending, as you know, about $400 billion a year. But that 75 number that the Defense Department uses is more than double the Chinese official number. So they already believe that the Chinese government is concealing defense spending. But this report also predicts that Chinese defense spending will go up approximately 500% in the next 20 years to be close to $300 billion. That is almost, in real dollars, almost as much as the United States is spending today. So there are people in the Pentagon who believe that this is an enormous issue. Now, should we be so worried about it? People who are optimistic on China say, look, if you look back at the 20th, they say two things, I think. One, if you, is that today, as I said, everything we know about China suggests that they will do whatever they can to keep fueling economic development. And when President Hu was in the United States in the spring, he emphasized strongly that China doesn't want to be a global military power. What they want is to be a developed economy. So that's today. And then people say, look back at Chinese history in the 20th century. If you look at Asian history in the 20th century, it was Japan, not China, that there was the aggressive power. And one can make that argument going back even further. So, you know, it's a real debate. But it's a debate that I think today is less, it's sitting in the background. The thing that's on the political agenda today, including in the Midwest, is about this trade deficit leads to an erosion of quality of life in the U.S. And I think that the potentially most important development for the world is the interaction of those concerns about the potential for China to become a military power and a military rival to the U.S., the interaction between that and this perceived reality today that unfair trade with China is reducing living standards and employment opportunities in the U.S., that's potentially an unbelievably powerful combination.
Just to go back to one of the points you made about when we were talking about the United States and Japan and about the fact that the United States, with the cooperation of Japan, was successful at reversing this trade imbalance, and in part it did it by increasing the value of the yen. We know what happened not all that long afterwards, and you say that the Chinese, this lesson is not lost on the Chinese, did in fact... The bubble economy in Japan and its collapse, can you really pin that on an overvalued yen?
Well, who knows? I mean, economic collapses of that magnitude are obviously a complex phenomenon. But what we know two things happened in Japan. Export competitiveness declined and domestic consumption declined more or less at the same time. And that was a very damaging damaging thing for the Japanese economy. But again, something that I'm sure so many people in the Midwest are aware of is that Japanese firms, multinational firms, and in particular in the auto sector, were not dumb about this. They saw the writing on the wall. They saw that that the yen was going to appreciate dramatically against the dollar, and they saw that there was going to be the Japanese economy was going to change quite dramatically, and that Americans were concerned about importing things from Japan. What did they do? They set up joint venture plans to produce automobiles in the United States that lowered their cost and curried support, you know, because of employment in the U.S. However, it was also true that having Japanese firms buying American assets was a charged topic, as you remember, in the late 80s, buying Pebble Beach, Rockefeller Center, Seattle Mariners. These were all big deals, but I don't think they were nearly as big a deal as the attempt by the Chinese national offshore oil company, CNOOC, to buy Unocal in a relatively small U.S. oil producer with most of its assets offshore in the summer of 2005, which led to an enormous reaction against in Congress. There was a House vote, 300 to 50, I think it was, a voice vote saying that this was a bad thing for the United States. So one of the things that might happen going forward is, I would predict, is likely to happen, is that the Chinese government and Chinese firms, and part of the problem is it's very hard to tell the difference between a Chinese notionally private firm and the government, but there'll be a lot of attempts to buy American assets. And I think that that will be politically a very sensitive issue in the United States, even though from a Chinese standpoint, and I think, you know, in terms of economic logic, it would make perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. We are almost in our midpoint here. I have a caller we will get right to. And for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I would like to introduce again our guest. Jeffrey Garrett is president of the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's also professor of international relations, business administration, communication, and law at the University of Southern California. He's an expert on the causes and consequences of globalization. He will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign next week. He'll be here on Monday to take part in a conference looking at globalization and the politics of economic adjustment. And this is sponsored in part by the folks at the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance. He'll be giving a talk on this very subject, Unpacking Globalization, What China Means for America, on Monday evening, beginning at 7:30 at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. And I'm sure that anyone who is interested in stopping by and hearing what he has to say should feel welcome. And here on the program, also, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. So if you're here in town where we are, use that one. But if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are
yes.
you? Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is under your purview or not, but I've been reading a lot extensively in the Asian publications, English language Asian business publications, and political ones about the serious environmental problems in China, the western edge of the western areas of China that are being, you know, the desertification and, you know, pollution. Some of the cities, like in satellite data, you can't even see the ground on some of these things that, you know, reminding you of like 19th century western cities if you had satellites back then, you know, with coal firing power plants and stuff. I mean, does anybody in your field ever consider the, like, 20-year outlook on this situation, because the Chinese government doesn't seem to be doing very much about it? The New York Times had a thing this morning about how the American car manufacturers just shipped all this high pollution, you know, polluting car equipment, you know, assembly equipment over there, not even giving them modernized engines and transmissions and things like that, and, you know, in emission systems, causing much more ground pollution in city, you know, urban pollution. I mean, I hear, you know, I listen to, you know, these lectures or these discussions on the radio a lot, and I don't hear anybody talking about this other than some cursory, yeah, they should do something about it. But I mean, if you've got a billion people, and if they begin to accelerate their consumption, this isn't that like a recipe for the ultimate disaster?
I mean, yes. Let me just. Yeah. I mean, this is an extraordinarily important topic, and I would tell you that where I am on the West Coast, it's an enormously salient issue. So yes, China has extraordinary environmental problems. They also, I think, there are two big things about China that, you know, that all of the buzz about China's economic miracle tends to overlook. One is that they have an extraordinary environmental problem. The second is that they have massive inequality between the booming coastal regions of China and the interior of the country. And to the Chinese government's credit, by the way, their 2006 five-year plan, the plan for how the economy should move in the next 5 years, stresses both of those problems as very high priorities for the government. But that's easy to say. What are you going to do about it? I think that there are at least two things, two important things that the United States can and should do to help the Chinese government address their environmental issues. One is market-based, which is to use the new technologies where the U.S. and Japan and Western Europe are leaders, both in energy efficiency and in clean energy, to help the Chinese transition from what is very much a 19th century dirty coal kind of economy, particularly with respect to electricity. So the market solution is to use new technology to help China. But I think there's a political fact that probably also bears some emphasis, which is that probably for good reasons, the United States, there are justifiable reasons why the United States chose not to ratify the Kyoto environmental protocols. China didn't ratify Kyoto either. And this creates a real problem because it's very hard for the U.S., for American officials, to get on a high horse about environmental degradation in China when the Chinese can turn around and say, yeah, but you didn't ratify Kyoto either. So I think a going forward place on the environment is for the U.S. to work with the rest of the international community, including China and India, and India is also a rising environmental challenge, to agree with the international community on a post-Kyoto environmental regime that everybody could sign on to and adhere to. So I think, yes, environment's incredibly important. There's a lot of win-win stuff that can happen with respect to new technologies, but that some government leadership, including from the United States, will be very important here.
Yeah. Oh, thanks a lot. I'll come to your lecture then. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit at the beginning, and I asked you to comment, expand on this line in the piece that you wrote about just how important the rise of China's economy is to the world economy, will be to the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that now more and more one is hearing people talk about the potential of several very large countries that have large populations and have significant resource bases of one kind or another, and the fact that we should look for them to grow and look for them to become within, we're talking about maybe a time horizon of 20 or 30 years, very significant players in the world economy. And the three that seemed always to come up are Brazil, China, and India.
Yes, the so-called BRICS. I also have, I'm sure you know that Goldman Sachs, it was a very influential investment bank before its former head, Hank Paulson, became Treasury Secretary. Goldman Sachs, in 1999, issued a report entitled Dreaming in BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Mm-hmm.
And the BRICS analysis projects that the Chinese economy will surpass the American economy in total size around 2041. They also predict, and the U.S. government actually agrees with this, that the Chinese economy will be the second largest economy in the world, that is, passing Japan, in about 2020. India is further off, and I think that Brazil's a different discussion. But if one thinks about India and China, the rise of China is today's economic reality. Further into the 21st century, I think we'll be talking more and more about India. But if one's going to use the time horizon that gets us, let's say, to 2025, I think the story is mostly going to be about China. But let me just add one thing here that I think is extraordinarily important. The nature of the U.S.-China economic relationship is bound to change and is changing today. If you look back 10 years, what the U.S.-China economic relationship has basically been one in which low-wage production of standardized goods, toys, bikes, clothing, have moved to China, and they've been sold by companies like Walmart back in the U.S. at very low prices. So American consumers have benefited, but people in the manufacturing sector, manufacturing jobs have gone down. So that's been the story of the U.S.-China economic relationship, let's say, for the past 15 years. Over the next 15 years, the relationship is going to be quite different, and there's already a lot of evidence that this is changing. It's going to be different in two ways. The first way is that a lot of innovation, as opposed to manufacturing, is already moving to China and to India because they have large numbers of high-quality highly educated scientists and engineers who can do a lot of the work that's done by the higher tech sectors of the American economy today, but do it at much lower price. So the first change, which is the one that Tom Friedman highlighted in his book, The World is Flat, is the rise of innovation in Asia, big challenge for the U.S. The second thing that is already happening is that China's economic model is going to change from being an exporter of low-cost goods to one driven by rising domestic demand in China. And what that means is that China's about to, the predictions are that there'll be, you know, hundreds of millions of new middle-class consumers coming onto the scene in China in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And what American firms are going to do is to try to sell to that market. However, all the indications are that the way to sell to the Chinese market is to be located in China. So the rise of Chinese consumers will probably be very good for American multinational firms in terms of their bottom lines. But it's probably not going to be the case that American firms employing Americans in the United States will be exporting a lot of goods to those, to the new Chinese middle class. So this transformation of the Chinese economy, I think, you know, in addition to all the just the heady numbers we see about the sheer magnitude of the Chinese economy, there's going to be this transformation in what the Chinese economy looks like that'll have dramatic effects for the United States.
Well, that's interesting. Let's talk with some more folks. We have some other callers, and we'll go here first to someone in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm actually a scholar of Japan and not China, but I do have great interest in China. I find this discussion very interesting, and I'm wondering about, speaking very general terms here, but if we would think of the U.S. vis-a-vis China as not thinking of China as being similar to the former, potentially the former Soviet Union, but rather that the U.S. is actually similar to the former Soviet Union. In other words, we're trying to preserve a kind of bipolar, or in this case unipolar now, hyperpower status, and that the U.S. government, especially in the case of the Bush administration, but not exclusively, that the U.S. tends to see that it cannot compete in sufficiently lowering manufacturing costs, something you've been talking about. And at the same time, of course, something I wanted to take note of is that the U.S. Government tends to compensate, at least in my view, for this financial dilemma through massive military spending. In other words, they tend to view China in specifically militaristic terms. They're certainly concerned with the economic aspect and are not, you know, unconcerned in that regard, certainly, but that perhaps the overemphasis on the military is a real impediment for understanding the place of the U.S. in the world and the place of China. And, of course, China is increasing its militaristic ambitions, but or military ambitions, but, of course, those tend to be concerned with Taiwan. China has no history historically of any real expansionist efforts, except, of course, concurrently in Tibet and so on. But something else that I thought was very useful that you took note of is that in the case of China and in India is that, contrary to the case of the United States or, let's say, the former Soviet Union, the secondary educational system is, and then, of course, at the university level, they're developing a tremendously strong educational systems, whereas the U.S., of course, we tend to, our universities are extremely good, but our, you know, there aren't very many Americans in the sciences, as you know.
Yeah, let me just, I mean, you've hit on some very important issues here. Let me just highlight one that that we haven't talked about thus far, which is that if you look at the U.S.-China political relationship today, the two most important elements in it are North Korea and Taiwan. And you know, I've spoken recently with some high-level Chinese officials who say that the U.S. the U.S.-China relationship is better than it's ever been, which is interesting when you think about all of this, all of the China bashing that I referred to with respect to economics in Congress. So why do they think that? They think it because President Bush has been quite cool towards the independence aspirations of the current Taiwanese government, and has been quite insistent on the perpetuation of the One China policy. And it, you know, for people who don't interact with Chinese officials, it's really hard to understand just how important this Taiwan issue is to them. And in that regard, they view the Bush administration very warmly. So then if you try to do some thinking about why is it that the Bush administration, after President Bush said very early on in his first term, of course I would defend Taiwan to the hilt, why was the Bush administration taken a more centrist position on Taiwan? I think the answer is that the Bush administration really needs China to do the heavy lifting with respect to North Korea. It's unclear that China is willing to do that, because most observers believe that China wants stability in North Korea even more than it wants a denuclearized North Korea. But from the Bush administration standpoint, China is the critical player in the North Korea debate. So I think that what's been going on in terms of geopolitics in Washington is that there's a marriage of convenience at the moment between the U.S. and China with respect to East Asia. Japan gets in the way of that for interesting reasons that we might talk about, but that lurking behind everything is the drumbeat of Chinese economic power potentially translating into Chinese military power. So we have a sort of short-term, long-term dichotomy there. In the short term, it's very important for the U.S., and certainly the Bush administration believes this, to have good geopolitical relations with China. Well, in the longer term, there's this potential problem, which is that the Chinese military will be by far the second most powerful in the world after the U.S.
Right. Do you think that, for example, if the Middle East problem over time, you know, the so-called war on terrorism dies down, which I think it will in some ways, but once that happens, that the U.S. will once again be extremely concerned with the Chinese and military?
Well, potentially, but I think bringing up the war on terrorism in the Middle East and energy is extraordinarily important because we know that China has insatiable demand for energy, and what they're trying to do is lock up supplies of energy from some pretty unsavory countries, Sudan, Iran, Venezuela. So the China's energy demands make it much less likely that the U.S. and China can come, for example, to a common agreement about how to deal with Iran, because energy gets in the way.
Right.
And even if the war on terrorism in its sort of overt form goes away, I think that that energy politics and China's energy needs is going to have an increasing impact on the world, not a decreasing one. And let me just finish with another observation on this, which is that, you know, the Soviet Union and China had a pretty rough relationship for many decades, going back to the late 50s and early 60s. But it's the case today that there's really a win-win for Russia and China, which is that Russia is an energy exporter and China is an energy importer, and they have big incentives to agree on a lot of stuff about the Middle East and about Central Asia, and their agreement tends not to go in the directions that U.S. policymakers would like it to.
Yeah, I noticed that Putin said that to someone, I think it was a public statement, that the biggest, well, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't public, I don't think, but he said that the biggest foreign policy concern for Russia today is the United States, what the United States will do next, which suggests, of course, that Russia, as with China, is in many ways very much concerned with what the United States will do.
Well, I think everybody's concerned with the with the U.S. at the moment.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Let's go on to another caller here. This would be line number two, and I think they're also in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
One of the things I haven't heard you talk about is the tendency of this administration to use China as its big banker and borrowing a lot of money from China. I mean, they don't have to beat us militarily to have us on the edge of the sword, right?
Yes, and that, I mean, that is a very important point, so thank you for bringing it up. So as the economics textbooks would tell you, the flip side of a large trade deficit with China is a current account surplus for the United States. What does that mean? It means that that Chinese asset holders, and in particular the Chinese government, are buying up lots of dollars and T-bills. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, calls this the global savings glut. And the consequence of that has been very salutary for the United States, because what it has meant is that interest rates have stayed unprecedentedly low in the U.S., fueling the housing boom that most people believe has been central to the U.S. economic recovery in the 2000s. Now, over time, and interestingly, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers has been harping on this recently, over time, it's not a smart strategy for Chinese asset holders to have all their money in the United States in T-bills. It would make much more sense for them to diversify their portfolio by buying real assets, firms in the United States, which would have two consequences. One, interest rates would probably go up as demand for treasury bills would go down. And second, there'd be a likely, we know, political backlash against the efforts of the Chinese government to buy firms that would start to be called national assets, strategic assets of the United States, as in the Unocal case last year. So managing that, managing a sort of a managed reduction in the economic imbalances between China and the United States, I think, is in everybody's interests. What the world economy and what neither country could afford is a radical slowdown in Chinese growth, a radical pullout of Chinese willingness to buy T-bills, etc. So that's why I think the visit of Secretary Paulson to China last month to try to establish a very high level ongoing economic dialogue with China is extraordinarily important.
Well, you know, the concern is that once you get, we've gotten so much debt, and I have no idea what the debt to China to support our, you know, our war in Iraq, for example.
Well, I can tell you the headline number, which is hits you between the eyes. The Chinese government now has about $1 trillion in foreign reserves. And most estimates are that about 60% of that is in dollar-denominated assets. So China's the United States probably owes China about $600 billion at the moment.
And it's going to get worse as they get more of these, you know, borrow it off of the budget, you know, the regular budget. It's extraordinary spending or whatever they want to call it. Haven't we just about, you know, if China gets to a certain level of confidence, they could destroy the whole economy of the United States.
Well, I mean, yes.
Corporations could just go to China, set up their home bases there, and, you know.
Well, both of those are very important themes, and I'm not sure I would take such an extreme view. But let me hit on the second one about U.S. firms moving to China. I just note a couple of iconic examples of that in the very recent past. One is Walmart. So last year, 2005, it's estimated that Walmart sourced about $20 billion in goods on its shelves in China. So this classic model of low-wage Chinese exports finding their way into the homes of American consumers. But just a couple of weeks ago, Walmart made an enormous purchase, and it was a purchase of a retail chain in China. And the reason they did that is that Walmart wants to prepare itself to use China not as a source for goods, but as a market for its goods. And that's a dramatic change. The second example I'd use is a Midwestern one, which is the collapse of Delphi Auto Parts. One of the things that Delphi did several years ago was to make its China operation independent from the American one. And while the American one is now in bankruptcy with unfunded pension liabilities, Delphi China is going gangbusters. And what it's doing is putting parts into automobiles that are sold in the Chinese market. China hasn't managed to become an automobile exporter yet, but its domestic auto market is expanding enormously, and it's happening not through wholly owned Chinese companies, but by joint ventures with international multinational automobile firms like General Motors. There's an unbelievably sophisticated, advanced Buick factory, for example, in Shanghai that one's always taken to when you visit.
Yeah, well, I can see in the near future the only exports the United States will have are farm goods and the brightest and best brains in the country. So thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. You've touched a couple of times on the on what happened last summer when the Chinese offshore oil company made the bid to buy Unocal.
Mm-hmm.
And also talked a little bit earlier about the Japanese experience and the fact that, at one point the idea of Japanese locating manufacturing facilities here in the United States was very controversial.
Yes.
And now I don't know that anybody has a real problem with driving a Honda, a Toyota, or a Mitsubishi that was built in the United States. Given the fact that seemed to be less controversial over time, do you see a point where the idea of the Chinese becoming more involved and maybe doing something like buying Unocal is a different case from Honda building a plant in Tennessee, but do you see a time when it would be the Chinese getting involved in that way in the American economy would be seem to be less controversial and less threatening?
In the short term, I would actually predict that it'll go in the other direction, which is it will become more controversial. And the reason for that is that there's actually quite a long and layered history of legislation in the United States which targets foreign investment in U.S. firms. The so-called CFIUS, Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States provisions, where there was the Exxon-Florio Amendment in the late 1980s, and before that, going way back to the beginning of the Cold War, there was the COCOM provisions, and then there were provisions against Chinese entities in the late 1980s after the Tiananmen Square disaster. So there's legislation existing on the books today that allows and in fact mandates the U.S. government to take a hard look at any purchase by a Chinese entity of an American firm and asking the question, does it in some sense threaten national security? And I think the question ultimately is how broadly does one define national security? In the case of Unocal, the congressional view was that, of course, buying an American oil company, even if it was an oil company that had most of its assets in Southeast Asia, was a threat to U.S. national security. And the reason was that energy was really important at the time. Energy is really important at the time, and the buyer was China, and China's a potential geopolitical rival. So I think the preconditions are there for some quite significant economic nationalism in the U.S. as Chinese entities, private and government, try to buy American firms. And I would just hasten to add that there's a really quite disturbing possibility that there would be a tit-for-tat element to this. The American business press, in particular Wall Street Journal, has picked up in the last month or so the fact that the Chinese government has enacted a new order called Order Number 10 that says that any purchase by a foreign entity of a major industry in China that threatens what they call state economic security must be okayed by the Ministry of Commerce in China, and that they can void any deal they want based on the notion that it might harm Chinese state economic security. Now, those are more explicit provisions than exist in the United States, but in both cases we have provisions that say that foreign purchase of our assets is something we should think about because there are some things that are more important than the efficient operation of the market, and national ownership might be one. I think this is a theme that's going to be increasingly on the political radar as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think we're about at the place. I'm sorry that we're going to have to stop. My apologies, we have a couple of callers that we're not going to be able to take here on the show. However, I do want to mention once again that our guest, Professor Jeffrey Garrett, will be here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk on this very subject, Unpacking Globalization, What China Means for America. It's part of a series program in looking at issues of globalization and the politics of economic adjustments, sponsored by the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance on the U of I campus. And this is taking place next week on Monday. He'll be giving the keynote address. This will be 7:30 in the evening at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. And if you'd like to find out more about this, you can just go to the website of the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance. It's www.csdg.uiuc.edu, or you can go through the U of I webpage and you can get more information. And I'm sure anyone who would be interested in attending that talk should certainly feel welcome. Again, our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Garrett, is president of the Pacific Council on International Policy and professor of international relations at University of Southern California. And Professor Garrett, thank you very much.
The pleasure has been all mine. It's been great to be with you this morning.